next Betty Carter with her own unique sound and musical styling with How High the Moon. Betty Carter was a committed mentor to new jazz talent and kept working at it up until the point when she was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer in the summer of 1998. And she died in September that year, but has left her statement in the community of jazz. This is Lead Stories. I'm Yatrice Lead. It is Thursday, March the 21st, and we are returning with our guest from yesterday. Our guest, we had the pleasure of talking with Abraham Bolden, who has an extraordinary story to tell. We were flooded with phone calls, so I want to get this piece of business done early. The number is 888-874-4888 for those of you wanting to ask questions. But of course, we will be talking a bit more with Mr. Bolden about his particular situation. Just to give you a background, Abraham Bolden was a young Secret Service agent in Chicago in 1960. When he was asked by President John F. Kennedy himself to join the White House Secret Service detail. By then, he had become the first African American in several law enforcement positions he had held, but this was a dream come true. Soon, though, Mr. Bolden found himself at odds with a sketchy security detail that he says was negligent, and he attempted on several occasions to make that known to his superiors. It was confirmed, he says in his book, when President Kennedy was assassinated on November the 22nd, 1963, and then began a very painful period of his life. He was falsely accused by the Secret Service itself of selling information to people who were indicted on fraud charges and federal crimes, and was on trial, placed on trial, convicted on three counts, and then sentenced to jail time for an act he did not commit. The witnesses, the key witnesses in the trial, recanted publicly. But even to this day, he cannot get his record expunged. And that has been the main reason for writing the book. The echo from Dealey Plaza, Dealey Plaza. The echo from Dealey Plaza, Dealey Plaza. To learn more about the book, you can go to the website. The website is echofromdealeyplaza.net. And there is a petition. I'm urging everyone today who listened to the program yesterday and, of course, would be listening today to examine the book, take a look at the website, and if you are inclined, and I hope you will be inclined, to sign the petition to expunge the record. To expunge the record. So, Mr. Bolden, thank you again for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me again, Yatrice. I'm very honored to be on your show again today.
Oh, not at all. The thing was that yesterday, as I said, we got so many calls, so many people wanting to talk with you, and I got so many emails as well from people who were extremely interested in what you had to say. And so I thought we would return. We didn't want to have too much distance between yesterday and another appearance, so we cleared the deck so that you could be with us today. Thank you so very much. Thank you.
Yes, I'm willing to answer any question that you have.
Okay. You got $1 million or so to lend a friend?
The answer to that question is no.
Well, I want to return to have you expound a little bit more on the crux of the matter, and that is, when you got to the security detail, the Secret Service detail, and you encountered racism, just raw, outright racism directed at you. But you nonetheless noticed that a major problem with the Secret Service detail was their professionalism and their capacity to actually protect the president. Could you talk about what you noticed and why you say in your book that the events of November the 22nd, 1963, confirmed what you had been trying to tell your superiors?
Yes. Now, what happened when I went in the United States Secret Service and became the first African-American to be assigned to the presidential detail, I had anticipated that I would receive some negativity because of my race. But as I said, I was absolutely shocked that the greatest amount of that negativity came from members of the United States Secret Service who were surrounding the president. Now, I wasn't there campaigning to do a great civil rights work or anything like that. But what I was trying to do was be an example and a sample for those who followed me and to do the best job that I could in carrying out the dictates of the Constitution of the United States and protecting the President of the United States, who at that time happened to be John F. Kennedy. Now, as I said, these were rough times in the 60s, and many of the young people should read about what was going on back in the 60s. I know it seems like a long time ago, but some of those things that happened in the 60s bear their consequences on today. They need to know about the different problems that were going on, such as the Freedom Bus Riots, the Voting Rights Act that was signed by President Johnson. They need to know about these things, Dr. Martin Luther King. They need to know the problems that we faced as a nation of people. And in delving into that, then we can go on to make some other choices that we're going to have to make in the near future in order to become full citizens of the United States of America, or take some other option that might be open to us. Now, in going into the Secret Service and becoming the first African American, as I say in my book, I was really shocked at the attitude that some of the agents surrounding the president had. And they were dead set against him because of his policies regarding racial equality and equality of opportunity. Now, they were calling him such names as Ian Lover, and they were saying that if anything should happen or anyone should try to assassinate the president, they wouldn't react because they were taking this on a personal basis. They didn't think very much of the president because of his attitude and what he was saying concerning the civil rights movement. Now, I thought that was rather shocking because here we were talking about not only a man, a human being, but we were talking about a president of these United States of America. And constitutionally, it was our charge to protect that president no matter who he would or who he was or who he stood for. That is the way I looked at it, and that's the only way that I could see it in my perspective as a Secret Service agent. Now, some had other ideas on that, and I found a lot of laxity in regards to protecting the president, the agents who were responsible for the follow-up cars and to do the advanced details whenever the president would travel. They would oftentimes get drunk, and they were very lackadaisical about their assignments. Now, you know, I was very troubled, Utrees. I read in the paper this morning where there were problems over in Israel with the current president's automobile. They put the wrong gas in the tank, and then it got stuck at the embassy over there, and hadn't anybody taken into account the weight of the vehicle. And when it came to the entrance of one of the embassies over there, it got stuck, and the president had to absolutely abandon the car and transfer into another car. Now, that happened twice. things such as that is pure negligence, and it shouldn't happen. That's what the Secret Service is there for, is to guarantee the safety of the president. Now you have a $3 or $4 million automobile with 11-inch thick size. It's really a tank. It's really a tank. The windows are 4 inches thick. And now we have the president has to abandon the car and get outside where his protection is very limited. So now things like that should be looked into. And I see that nothing much has changed since the 1960s. And that somewhat worries me today.
Could I locate you on the issue of the day of the assassination? That you write in your book, there were some very questionable actions by the Secret Service specifically on that day. Could you elaborate on that?
Yes, the moment that I heard that the president was had been shot, I was here in Chicago doing some work on a counterfeiting case at one of the local bars, and it came on the television that the president had been shot. I knew right away, by my experience, I haven't been on the detail, that more than likely, before the shot hit the president, the agents had been lax in some way. They were probably out drinking because it was their custom to go out drinking the night before the president would make a move during the daytime, and that they were lax on the assignment. I also anticipated, without hearing any more facts about the assassination, that the agents who were following the president in the follow-up car did not move or do anything to protect the president, because some of the agents were discussing that when we were in Hinesport, how they would not move, how they would not cover the president, how they would let it happen. And that's exactly what happened in Dallas, Texas on November the 22nd. I also had anticipated that the Secret Service would be lax in leaving open windows along the route where the president was supposed to be in this motorcade. I anticipated those things because I had discussed such things with the chief of the United States Secret Service in warning him that the president was in a very dangerous situation, because we were having lots of threats, international threats against the life of the president and national threats against the life of the president, when his security detail around him were less than adequate. And there was not enough training, there was not enough responsibility, and they had, some of the agents had a very deep dislike for the president, which was very dangerous, because it would reflect on their ability to respond in an emergency situation.
But then there were some other actions that you came in your book, you came to call very suspicious on that day, the movements. One person, you made reference to the grassy knoll.
Yes. Well, not only that. Now, those were not my interpretation. Shortly after the president was assassinated, there were some agents who were there in Dallas, Texas during that time who had said that they thought that the shots came from the grassy knoll, that there were some shots that came from the grassy knoll, which would have been in the front of the president's automobile. Now, these came through the Secret Service office by teletype. Now, then all of a sudden, all of the activity was focused on Lee Harvey Oswald. Now, I want to make it crystal clear that I wasn't in Dallas, Texas. And when it comes to the Dallas, Texas actual assassination, most of my information is generated from the custom of the Secret Service, what I heard when I was on the detail that was said to me so far as protecting the president is concerned, and what agents had said immediately after the president was assassinated. So I wasn't an eyewitness to the assassination, but I was to many of the things that happened to cover up the Secret Service inactivity during the assassination.
But you also referenced in your book that your own absence on that day was, in fact, in hindsight, questionable, because for although you were known to be quite serious about your job, and therefore seen by those who did not like the president as a likely ally of his, for lack of a better term, among the Secret Service agents, that you were assigned to Chicago on that day.
Yes, that's right. Well, I had left the Secret Service White House detail in August of 1961 and asked to be returned back to Chicago, Illinois, because I could see that things were so hot during that period of time, and I was going to get in trouble if I had stayed on the detail, simply because that the racism on that detail was so obvious and so aimed at me as to either sometime later I would have to respond against it, or either that I would have to leave the detail and come back to Chicago and pursue other investigative procedures here in Chicago. But I did go back to Washington, D.C. on November the 18th. I was called to Washington, D.C., and at which time they told me I was going to work for another section of the Treasury Department. They were going to change my name. They were going to, in fact, wipe Abraham Bolin off the face of the earth, give me a new identification, and I was to go undercover in Washington, D.C. Well, I was very suspicious at that assignment because, number one, why would they want to wipe Abraham Bolin off of the map and give me another identification and move my family and everything around? And this, to me, was very suspicious. And during that particular time, there were some serious threats that were going on to assassinate President Kennedy. So I kind of somewhat thought that this might have something to do with these plots to assassinate President Kennedy, and I turned down the assignment.
We're talking with Abraham Bolden, the first African-American assigned to the White House Secret Service, and his recollections as written in his book, The Echo from Dealey Plaza, which, of course, is available. And you can find out more about the project, which is to expunge his record, at Echo from Dealey, D-E-A-L-E-Y, plaza.net. The number is 888-874-4888 to speak with Mr. Bolden. So one fast thing, and then we'll take a break and come back to questions, I'm sure. I wanted to talk about the person, Mark Lane. Mark Lane enters this picture. Mark Lane was a very, very well-known attorney. How did he happen to come into contact with you?
Mark Lane was doing research for a book, Rush to Judgment, one of his first books. And I give credit to Mark Lane, who is my attorney at the present time and who is working on a documentary that is featuring both me and him to be released soon at some of the theaters and on HBO channel. But now, Mark Lane believed me from the beginning, and he did an investigation on my case, and he put it in his book, The Rush to Judgment. And he was bringing out how I was kidnapped out of Washington, D.C. In May of 1964, brought back to Chicago, held without an attorney, and how the conviction against me was so rancid that it was almost unbelievable. So Mark Lane somewhat watched my case as I went through the process and through the prison. He kept in contact with me and assisted me in any way that he could in making sure that the government couldn't carry out a plot in order to declare me insane or do something underhanded that would further increase my difficulties.
And what came of the information that he put? Did it further put you in danger, the information that he revealed in Rush to Judgment?
Yes, at one time it did. At one time it did. I was called in by the prison authorities, and they told me that I had stuck my nose in something that that I should keep my nose out of, and that they were going to teach me a lesson while I was there. And that was a precursor of them sending me over to the psychiatric ward in an attempt to declare me insane, which I cover in my book, The Echo from Dealey Plaza. Sure, when anything would come up about my case while I was incarcerated, where Mark Lang would speak or some of the other researchers would speak, it would make it somewhat difficult for me at times because then the institutional authorities would isolate me and put me away from the population as somewhat of a punishment for what they were saying outside of the institution.
And could you describe, Mr. Bolden, the effort to have your record expunged as opposed to seeking a pardon?
Yes. Right now, as the situation is, in order to get a pardon, there is a clause in there that says explain your occurrences in the crime. Well, I never committed a crime, so I can't answer a section and explain anything about the details of a crime that was never committed, and where a witness, one of the key witnesses, has already recanted his testimony and said that he and another witness set this whole thing up against me with the okay and with the advice of the United States Attorney here in Chicago, Illinois. Now, so my only activity in my direction is towards expunging the record, and I would like for President Obama to issue an executive order, which he can, he has the power to do, clearing my conviction and vacating my conviction making my name clear. That's what I want to do now.
Your calls at 888-874-4888. We'll take them right after this short break. That's Betty Carter playing her voice as the ultimate musical instrument. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead, and our guest today is Abraham Bolden. This is his second time around to accommodate your questions and comments at 888-874-4888. Mr. Bolden, do people in the Secret Service community seek you out for advice these days, or have they ever been in touch with you? Do they support you in any way?
There have been a couple, but mostly I'm a pariah so far as agents are concerned. There have been a few who have sought me out, and some have even went so far as to give me information in an attempt to help me. But basically, they're somewhat afraid because now, you know, there are 57 agents who have filed a discrimination suit, which is active right now in Washington, D.C., claiming prejudice within the Secret Service ranks and a lack of promotions, a lack of fair treatment. So nothing much has changed since the 1960s. So those who were saying that I was lying and there was no discrimination within the Secret Service have to face the fact that even now agents have filed a class action suit in Washington, D.C., claiming the same problems that I had back in 1961.
Do you find that ironic, considering that we have an African-American president?
Well, I think that by us having an African-American president, they feel that they're going to get a better shake. But I don't know if that's true or not. But I think that they feel that the courts may look at this with an open mind, with the possibility that something might occur that would alleviate the situation, the racial situation that is prevalent right now within the Secret Service.
Wow. You know, that is very interesting because it is such a closed society. One would think that at that level, you would have the absolute ultimate in professionalism and the very best of the best of the best. But when you describe these things, the names that you were called, the things that were done, and even not just to you, but even to the head of the country, the president of the United States, one wonders, is it simply a racial issue, or is it, I'm going now in the world of spying and that clandestine world, is it possible that somewhere the Secret Service is itself open to infiltration by other forces?
Well, I definitely think, but I don't have any firsthand evidence, but I definitely think that the Secret Service has been infiltrated. Now, let me express this. I have no firsthand information on that, but there are just too many coincidences that are happening within the Secret Service at this time that make me very suspicious whether or not that they're sincerely interested in maintaining and protecting the life of President Obama. It's just too many instances of laxity around him, of putting the wrong gas in the gas tank, of affiliating with prostitutes, leaving secret documents laying around on the sidewalk. There are just too many instances like that that kind of leave me concerned so far as the safety of the president is concerned.
Who ultimately has the authority to do something about that?
That would be the chief of the United States Secret Service, or that would be Ms. Napolitano, who is in head right now. She's in charge of the
Homeland Security.
Yes, that's right. She's in charge of that now. So that any changes that would be made within the Secret Service would have to come through her. Now, the president had a wonderful opportunity to make some changes within the Secret Service because Mr. Sullivan, who was the chief of the United States Secret Service, just resigned, and the president was looking for a replacement. Now, rather than replace Mr. Sullivan with one of the more experienced agents, there's an agent in New York, I think he's a African-American agent. I think he's been around almost 30 years. He was passed over as chief of the United States Secret Service, and someone was called out of retirement. Now, I'm not saying that that the person who was called out of retirement, I think his name was Agent Stevens, but I'm not saying that he isn't qualified. I'm just saying this, that if you have a retired agent and you have agents who are already in service who have 25 to 30 years experience, it seems to me that working from the inside of those agents who are still among the Secret Service and are still experienced and qualified to be the Chief of Secret Service, seems to me that they would at least get a good look at the possibility of assuming that position.
I don't want to foresee this ever happening, but what do you think your contribution has been or will be to this particular area of service?
Well, I think that number one, it serves to as a reminder of the people that we're not there yet. Number two, I wanted to bring about a book that would open up to discussion some of the advances that we have made and some of the things that we have to do in order to continue the advancement. Now, this is a long project. It deals with many, many things. And so it's just that I was hoping to achieve some type of change in the country and in the construction in the Department of Justice that would assure all Americans of a fair trial, of a fair and impartial trial before a fair and impartial judge, which I did not receive. I wanted to bring the light on what happens to many of the controversial prisoners who are sent into the federal prison system, how they deal with recalcitrant type of prisoners who they dislike, giving them drugs and drugging them down, psychotropic drugs and things like that, which is against not only the laws of America, but also against the international laws. So I wanted to bring those things to light so that the American people would be fully advised as to some of the things that that a so-called whistleblower has to deal with.
Well, we're getting some messages via the Facebook. One says, this is from Larry Henderson. He says, amazing. I just got the book and signed the petition. Thank you for finding this unsung guest. So so at least now you're sung.
Thank you.
No longer unsung. 888-874-4888 is the number to call to ask our guest, Mr. Abraham Bolden, a question or to share with him your comments and your views. Mr. Bolden, I have to tell you how I came to know you. It was a listener from this program who wrote me a note saying, you have to talk to this man. This man has written a book, and it is explosive. And the person thought it would have been appropriate to do it in February. Of course, I got a little late notice on that. But I read the excerpts of the book, and of course, when you sent me a copy of the book and I read it, it was just so incredible, and yet so consistent with what I would consider pioneers, the experience of pioneers. There's hardly any field of endeavor where African Americans are concerned where we find it an easy task at what they did. You know, they go into these things with the most noble of hopes and aspirations, with the most sincere desire to serve, and encounter trenchant racism that in the end just sometimes overwhelms them, overcomes them. And this is a consistent story, I see. You, whether you claim the word pioneer or not, that's what you are. You are a pioneer at this level of service. And I see this referencing African Americans, especially, who have been in all these spheres of, I would say, the law enforcement community, if you will. I knew a detective in Harlem. He's since passed. A wonderful, wonderful man, Detective Johnson, whose pride was that in all of his years on the force, in police force in New York City, not once did he ever have to use his gun. And yet he was in all these very dicey situations. People who talk with pride about the fact that their service was just so pristine, and yet they were subjected to the most animalistic treatment. So does it occur to you, I know you sound like a very modest man, but does it occur to you that in fact you are a pioneer and you have blazed a trail, whether others choose to recognize it or not?
Yes, it has occurred to me, but if you'll notice in the book that that it's a very spiritual book. And that yes, many of these things that happened to me, I had already been forewarned of them, even though I didn't know when that they were going to take place. as my concealment in the steel vessel that I talk about in the first chapter of the book. And the woman and three children who were standing outside this vault that I was trying to contact and I couldn't reach. So there are many mystical things in the Echo from Dealey Plaza that if a person really reads it and thinks about it, meditate on it a little bit, they'll see something else in the book too, other than concerning President Kennedy. They will see the workings of a strange hand of God that followed me all through my endeavors to clear myself, to go through what I had to go through. They would see a spirituality there, an unseen hand, that the stone that was cut out of the side of the mountain without hands. They'll see all of that, and they'll see many things that will make sense of them if they just relate them on the spiritual plane instead of just the material plane. And,
yes, because you do talk about receiving, as it were, instructions on what your next move should be, from an almost cosmic source that you saw.
Yes,
you had,
right.
You call them visions.
Yes, right.
And that they came to you at extremely low points in your time, especially in your time of incarceration.
Yes,
were you prior to being incarcerated, prior to coming to the Secret Service, were you a spiritual man?
Yes, very much so. My family was very spiritual, too. As I said, I longed to get the knowledge to do something to help my people, and that's my goal now, is to do whatever I can to help the American people, not only black people, but white people too. I want to see us come together. I want to do something or write something or go on a tour to bring the American people together, to make man in this universe all brothers, which we all are. I want to bring forth a new truth, a new reality that puts in the mind of the people that there is hope, that the key is in our possession, and it's just for us to dig it out, seek it out, and become one with our Creator. And that's a message that I'm working on to bring before the people at this present time.
Well, I would do this. We would end it here today only because I think we are getting more emails than phone calls. So I would like to forward these emails to you so that you can respond to them. We're getting quite a bit of that. What has happened, I believe, and this is what is going on today, people are at work and they cannot speak at length. So they have been writing instead of speaking. So I would forward these emails to you. And I thank you very much, Mr. Bolden, for making yourself available today, for helping us understand your predicament. And certainly, I encourage people to visit the website, go to it, Echo from Dealey Plaza, DEALEY Plaza.net. Take a look at the petition. And if you are inclined to sign, sign the petition. And let's see if we can get Mr. Bolden's wrongful incarceration, wrongful conviction expunged. Mr. Bolden, I sincerely thank you for being with us today.
And thank you very much for having me.
All righty. All right. Well, now that he's gone, we're getting phone calls on there. Well, I'll take this call. Laura from New Jersey. You're on? Hello? Is Laura from New Jersey there?
Yes, I am. Can you hear
me? Okay, yes, great. Now
yes,
I can hear you.
Hi, Patrice. Wonderful show. I had two questions for Mr. Bolden, and perhaps you can pass them on to him. I was going to ask him about what his advice he might have for others who want to, you know, maintain their integrity, honor, and dignity despite all the behavior in the workplace and social environment. Mm-hmm. Since he had experienced so much of that. And then my second question for him was, you know, how he might describe how his children navigated through all his ordeal of false conviction and then incarceration.
In your own life, have you experienced anything like that? Opposition on the basis of who you are, or have
yes,
you?
Yes, certainly, but not anywhere near to that degree.
No. We all have varying degrees of it. But it is, you know, on the one hand, we see the nobility of this because it's presented as a personal experience.
Yes.
But when you look at the same experience or the same nature of the experience multiplied millions of times, you get a sense of what's wrong with America, you see.
These
are people, it would be one thing if you and Mr. Bolden and other folks come to the world of work with a nasty attitude, with a, you know, I don't care whether I do my job, let alone whether I have a job, and you know, just bad news all the way around. But you have this sense where people are very, very serious about making a good contribution to what they do, and then you run into forces that are just plain evil.
Yeah.
And they're hell-bent on making your life miserable as well.
So true.
Yes.
There's so much of that. I just hope that individuals like Mr. Bolden, like yourself, that so many of us who can somehow maintain our integrity and dignity and morality and ethics and somehow manage to perhaps change the tide, I hope we can reach some kind of critical mass.
I'm hoping so, too. Thank you very much, Laura.
Thank you.
For your question. Thank you. Well, I want to make some notes because we're going to wrap up the program very shortly. We're running out of time. I do recognize, and that's one of the notations I get from a lot of people, that at the time that the program is on, many are listening at work and are unable to make calls. I get that. That's really a very serious consideration. But we proceed. I will get your messages, and I will pass them on. And I make it a point, really, to respond to any correspondence directed at me as well. So we still have a community of communication going. I need for us to take on seriously an attitude about what can be done rather than look at the obstacles in our path. Look, life is about obstacles. We're going to have them. We're going to have to deal with them. And we have to be pragmatic and practical, which is why I love the fact that people write. I mean, that's the solution, right? You can't talk on the phone at work. You write. Perfect. That's the solution. So that means there's a genius at work. But I want us to begin to develop as a group, let's say for this program, for the station, but I'm talking about this program, people who identify with what we're trying to do here, which is to create a community through communication and the sharing of information. We are to encourage each other to be mature, to deal with opinions, even if we disagree with them, but to at least appreciate the journey that the person offering the opinion has made toward an opinion. That itself is fantastic. But I want us to take on a bit more responsibility as a group about the things that we can do to make a definitive difference in the scheme of things. It may be as simple as signing a petition, or it may be as complex as organizing to run for office as a true alternative. These are the things we start to take on and step away from the theory of it and get to the practicality and pragmatism of it. We got to not just talk the talk, we have to walk the walk. And I'm willing to go with baby steps. And in baby steps, one thing is we have to grow this audience. I'm very serious about that. By that I mean we're doing very well. Don't get me wrong. We're doing well, and I'm happy about that. But I'm interested in taking things always to the next level. and making this an excellent exchange point for all of us. So join me tomorrow at the same time. Write me at leadstories@gmail.com or on Facebook at facebook.com/leadstories. Let me hear from you and let's stay in touch. See you tomorrow. Thanks.